People talk about Dead Horse Bay as being covered with garbage. And I suppose that's not wrong.
Dead Horse Bay is on the southern coast of Brooklyn, near the Rockaways. The beach is pretty shallow, and it's looking out over the Jamaica Bay. But in the sand is embedded every kind of trash you can imagine. Glass bottles, old tires, batteries. We were there a few months ago with Robin Nagel, a professor at New York University, and the anthropologist in residence for the city's Department of Sanitation.
Robin researches trash and what trash can tell us about ourselves. And the garbage on this particular beach has a powerful story to tell.
As she walked along Dead Horse Bay with us, Robin stopped to look at this tangled mess of nylon stockings that was partially emerging from the sand.
We will see these, to me, kind of very creepy accidental sculptural creations of nylons that have tangled around each other. But sometimes you'll pull one out of this mass, and if you cleaned it, you could wear it, you know, because it is not going to decompose anytime soon.
Speaking of things that aren't decomposing anytime soon, at another end of the beach, we found kitchen appliances. There was a sink, there was half of a stove, and nearby, halfway emerged from a bank of sand was...
And the chassis of a car, maybe? Yes, wow! Look at that!
Oh my God!
It's the whole car! The bumper is still... Wow! And the steering wheel and the...
Yep, an entire car. And it looked kind of like a skeleton. The bones of the front of the car were these rusting ribs emerging from the sand. The steering wheel was still attached, and one of the tires had its rubber traction.
All right, so Krissa, where did all of this trash come from? It didn't float there, right?
No, that's right. This beach, which is sometimes called Glass Bottle Beach or Dead Horse Bay, is actually the top of a poorly covered landfill.
Much of what is here came from homes that were torn down to make way for highways and other forms of urban renewal, quote unquote. And the people whose homes they were, they couldn't take everything with them. So you could call it garbage, or you could call it the ruins of a part of our own recent past that were involuntarily created because people without the means to protest or without enough power in city politics, we're simply told you got to get out of the way.
Okay, so let's back up. In the 1940s and 50s, Robert Moses, who was the Parks and Planning Commissioner at the time, had these massive construction projects planned in New York City. He wanted to build parks and highways. He wanted to build stadiums and public buildings. And to do all of that, some estimates say that his projects displaced over 500,000 people.
And pushing out these 500,000 people also meant knocking down their homes, which, as you can imagine, created a lot of trash. Robin says that a lot of that material was brought out to Dead Horse Bay, and a massive landfill was created to extend the land in Brooklyn. That newly created land made way for Floyd Bennett Field and Marine Park.
The debris was trucked in from all over New York City, but there are clues in the trash that tell us that at least the top layer of the landfill is stuff that specifically came from Brooklyn. One of the ways that we know that is that students at Trinity School in Manhattan took field trips to Dead Horse Bay to collect garbage, and these kids found calendars from Dime Savings Bank in Brooklyn and prescription bottles from Brooklyn pharmacies. And that's only the topmost layer of the landfill. So there's much more to discover about who these objects came from. And that's what Robin wants to figure out.
I see this place as like this quiet, not a cry for recognition so much as just, why would we not want to learn whatever we can about this for our own understanding of this place that is part of us? You know what I mean? It's our story too, even as we are not the people whose roller skates and car tires and light fixtures are scattered on the beach. Mm-hmm. But maybe they were our parents or grandparents or somebody's parents and grandparents, right?
For anyone looking to discover more about these artifacts, the shifting landscape of Dead Horse Bay provides a challenge. The land is constantly changing as more trash gets swept out into the sea and the landfill continues to erode. So in the next few months, that car that we discovered, it might not even be there. It might be underwater.
And as it continues to erode, people like Robin can hopefully find more clues about the origins of these objects and the stories that led to their forced removal. So today, we're asking what trash can tell us about structures of power. I'm Krissa Corbett-Kavoris.
And I'm Adwa Aduse. You're listening to Borrowed.
But to really understand Dead Horse Bay, I think we need to start even earlier, because this part of Brooklyn actually has another story to tell about trash and power.
Okay, let's hear it.
So in the mid-1800s, before it was Dead Horse Bay, before the nylons and the kitchen stoves, this place was actually an island, and it was called Barren Island.
And it was pretty remote and hard to get to from the rest of Brooklyn because of weather and tides and erosion and it was considered a good place for what so-called nuisance industries.
This is Miriam Sisherman. She joined our producer and Robin Nagel at Dead Horse Bay a few weeks ago. Miriam is an elementary school teacher in Manhattan, and she also happens to have just finished a book about Barren Island, which is awesome because there aren't a lot of books out there that cover this part of Brooklyn and the people who used to live here. Here's Miriam again.
So starting in the 1850s, really smelly and gross factories were here for processing garbage, for processing fish oil, fertilizer, and for processing dead animals, especially horses, which there were thousands of that died every year in New York City back then.
So the gruesome name for the island is literally just that gruesome?
Yeah, and to this day, you can actually find horse bones on the beach from the days when horse carcasses were rendered into things like fertilizer and glue. And that work didn't get done without a lot of effort. So there were a lot of people living on Barren Island who processed the garbage.
It was always a combination of typically new immigrants and African Americans. And the African American men mostly worked in the fish processing plants, which that was kind of considered the grossest, most horrible job. And it was typically, according to the census, from those days, these were black men who were mostly born in Virginia or Delaware, and in the early days, they probably had been born into slavery. And then there were a lot of new immigrants. According to some articles I've read, some people went directly from Ellis Island to Barren Island.
So at any given time, there were several hundred immigrants and people of color, some of whom would have been refugees from the American South, living out on the island, doing this work that no one else wanted to do.
And I can't imagine it smelled very good either.
No, and of course, these smelly industries gave Barren Island a pretty bad reputation.
There were a lot of complaints about the smell, and not just that it was disgusting, but in those days, a lot of people believed it was really a health hazard.
But, you know, the people who actually lived on the island weren't that bothered by the smell. For the most part, they liked where they lived, especially if you compared it to some of the other housing options available to immigrants and people of color at the time.
If you think about what the Lower East Side was like in the late 19th century, like people were crowded into these like really unsanitary, unhealthy conditions, and diseases would spread. People had no fresh air. And here, people had fresh air. They had a lot of fresh food because everyone had a garden and everyone went fishing. And they had space to run around and have leisure activities. And it was healthier, actually.
So another thing I find fascinating about Barren Island that evokes what Miriam is talking about, the sense that it was this rural bucolic place, is that people used to keep free roaming pigs on the island, like 500 of them in 1909. And this was long after the city had otherwise outlawed free roaming pigs. So sadly, one day the health department caught on, boarded a ferry to the island, and in one afternoon shot all the pigs.
That's so sad. We should say that there were other animals, though, right?
Yeah, people were fishing a lot on Barren Island, too. One resident who contributed his oral history to the Gateway National Recreation Area a few years ago remembers a local boy set up a cage out in the waves to keep the fish fresh until they were sold, which sounds delicious. And part of the reason I mention these stories is that for Miriam, the aim of writing her book was to elevate and honor the story of the people who did the city's dirty work, because this was a community so neglected by the rest of the city.
There was never running water. There was never any sort of firefighting apparatus, even though there were fires at these garbage plants a lot. And the Barren Islanders still, they were a really mixed community. They were being neglected by the authorities, and they still were able to create a really highly functioning community here, which I think is just cool.
At its most populous in the early 20th century, Barren Island had a population of around 1,500. But by the 1920s and 30s, Barren Islanders had started to move away. The last people on the island were evicted in 1936 to make way for the Marine Parkway Bridge, yet another project of eminent domain. These final residents were only given a month to move out. before their homes were bulldozed.
So Barren Islanders, who had already been pushed out to the edge of Brooklyn to process garbage, were then forced out for the sake of construction?
Yeah. These two stories, the garbage processors on Barren Island and the trash from displaced people pushed out to Dead Horse Bay, they have something in common. They're both stories about power and geography. What we do with our trash, where we pick it up, and then where we put it says a lot.
You know, Krista, this story of Barren Island actually reminds me of another story we can find right here in Brooklyn Public Library's archives. It's about how trash became a power struggle at the height of the civil rights movement in Brooklyn. So let's leave Dead Horse Bay and go to Central Brooklyn, where in 1962, Brooklyn Core took on a somewhat surprising enemy, garbage collection. Bed-Stuy in 1962 was a hive of community organizing around civil rights. And one of the most visible organizations was Brooklyn's chapter of the Congress of Racial Equality, or Brooklyn Core for short.
Now, at the time, did people say that Brooklyn Core was the, you know, a radical branch of Core? I mean, was it kind of understood?
Yeah, Brooklyn Core had a reputation.
Okay.
That if you had a demonstration and you wanted other Core chapters to come,
right,
tell them Brooklyn Core was going to be there.
Uh-huh.
In the early 2000s, a researcher named Brian Purnell set out to tell the story of Brooklyn Core. He interviewed dozens of people who had been active in Brooklyn during the fight for racial equality in the 60s. And after he had written a book about it, he donated his oral histories to Brooklyn Public Library, which is what you're hearing now.
You know, we lived here in New York City where everybody was thinking of themselves as upwardly mobile and free.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
In order to attract attention and to really drive the point home, Brooklyn Core would use drama.
That's the voice of Bob Law. In the 1960s, Bob was a student at Pratt and an activist with Brooklyn Core when the group organized a protest to address unfair garbage collection in Bedford-Stuyvesant.
Where exactly did you pick up the garbage from?
I'm not sure again, but I would say in the general area of Fulton and Nostrum.
Brian also interviewed Msamaji and his wife Nandi Wayusi in 2001. Msamaji was a postman in Bed-Stuy in the 60s and also lived in the neighborhood. So he saw firsthand what trash collection was actually like.
Why did they do that? I mean,
okay, I remember it again, and you have to understand that we're talking about a long time ago.
Yeah, this happened in 1962.
Okay. The people in the area were dissatisfied with the way garbage was being collected. The garbage men would come by, supposedly clean, to collect the garbage, but still, when they left, the place would be very filthy.
Mm-hmm.
Because when they pick up garbage, if something fell out the can, they wouldn't necessarily bend down and pick it up or go back for it. It just stayed there.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike our understanding was in other neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. So garbage collection in Bed-Stuy only happened 3 days a week back then. It used to be collected 6 days a week, but during World War II, the city cut back collection. And eventually, when the population of Bed-Stuy exploded in the 50s and the 60s, making it one of the largest Black communities in Brooklyn, garbage collection did not keep up. So members of Brooklyn Core dug deeper and found that in predominantly white communities with a lower housing density, which basically means that fewer people were living in the same amount of space, those neighborhoods, they had garbage pickup happening 5 days a week in comparison to the 3 days in Bed-Stuy.
I see. So Brooklyn Core is discovering racial discrimination in the municipal services in Brooklyn.
Basically, yes. And they decided to do something about it. Members of Brooklyn Core asked city government to fix the problems of dirty streets, but the city's response blamed residents for not taking care of their neighborhood. So on the morning of Saturday, September 15th, activists picked up brooms and trash cans and followed the garbage trucks. Here's Msamaji again. He took part in the protest.
In other words, we went after the truck, and the garbage we picked up was the garbage that they should have picked up.
Mm-hmm.
And we wound up, we hired a U-Haul and put this stuff in cans or bags or whatever on the U-Haul and took it down to City Hall and deposited it on the steps of City Hall.
Here's Bob Law again.
Throwing that garbage on the steps of City Hall was emotionally gratifying.
Mm.
You know, it was like, man, striking a blow. You know, it was like, here, take this garbage back. you know, if you, it, it was, you got the sense of fighting back.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we said was that, and not only now, but we will come back again next week,
mm-hmm.
until you pick up this garbage. Because we say that what we're asking for is very reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And until you pick up this garbage, we will bring this garbage back down here again and again.
Wow, that must have been quite a sight. So did it work?
In some ways, yes. Operation Clean Sweep, as it came to be known, forced those in power to pay attention to how municipal services are distributed. The sanitation department added more trash cans on street corners and started picking up bulk twice a week instead of just the once. But there was no 5-day garbage pickup, which was one of the demands. And there were still a lot of unfair conditions in the neighborhood that activists would continue to fight for, and in some cases, they still are fighting.
Right, so Operation Clean Sweep electrifies the community and delivers this message to politicians. What we do with our garbage matters.
Absolutely. It was just one protest in a series of actions by Brooklyn Core. They continued to protest housing discrimination, segregation in public schools, and racist hiring practices throughout the 1960s. Their stories are important to return to, especially today, and you can come into the library to hear them. They're part of our Civil Rights in Brooklyn oral history collection. We've put a link to it in our show notes.
And while we're plugging the Brooklyn collection, I will say that we have some incredible photographs of Barron Island in the early 1900s, so we're putting those on the show page too. And now it's time for our book match segment. Joining us to recommend a few books for you guys is librarian Melissa Marone. Hey, Melissa.
Hi, Krista. Thanks for having me.
So we've just spent this whole episode talking about trash and what it can tell us about inequality in the city and the power of activism. So you have put together a list of books on the topic. What's the first one you've got?
Yeah, well, so the first one is very related to trash in one of its chapters. It's Fighting Jim Crow in the County of Kings. Subtitled The Congress of Racial Equality in Brooklyn. So this is a rather academic book by Brian Purnell. And so as you've been hearing in this episode, Brian Purnell's book talks about Operation Clean Sweep and really goes into how it came to be and how this activist project really had an impact on people's everyday lives in the city.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So what's your second book?
So my second book is called Fear City, New York's Fiscal Crisis and the Rise of Austerity Politics by Kim Phillips Fine. It tells the story of the fiscal crisis in New York City in the mid-70s and how the actions of government and the financial industry and even less expected, perhaps, characters like union leadership pushed New York City to become a very different place with much greater inequality. But the reason I wanted to bring it up for this episode is because it also does include stories of neighborhood activism that you can really dig into, including a Greenpoint community's intense efforts to save their firehouse from closure,
mm-hmm.
and the fight to save Hostos Community College.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a really important read.
Yeah. And that's not unrelated to the last book, I think, that you have in terms of fights for inequality in New York.
Definitely not. And in terms of chronology, it kind of picks up
yeah.
where Brian Purnell's story ends.
Yeah. And what's the last book you've got?
So the last book, so unlike the other two, I think that this next book is something that you can really kind of fall into, lose track of the sense of time passing as you read it. It's The Edge Becomes the Center, An Oral History of Gentrification in the 21st Century. Which is by D.W. Gibson. It's about New York City as a whole with a lot about Brooklyn. So it's a really kind of impressionistic but also documentary
right.
work that I think is important for years to come.
Yeah, and actually Gibson's book was the nonfiction winner of our 2015 Lit Prize, which was the inaugural year that we had the Brooklyn Eagles Literary Prize. Definitely a great book, and I like impressionistic. That's a good way of putting it. Everybody, that was Fighting Jim Crow in the County of Kings by Brian Purnell, Fear City, New York's Fiscal Crisis and the Rise of Austerity Politics by Kim Phillips Fine, and last, The Edge Becomes the Center, An Oral History of Gentrification in the 21st Century by D.W. Gibson. So we're putting a link to that complete list on the website. It'll include those titles and also a few more that Melissa has selected for the episode. So you can check them all out right here at BPL. Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.
BARD is brought to you by Brooklyn Public Library and is hosted by me, Adwa Duse, and Krista Corbett-Kavouras. You can find a transcript of this episode at our website, bklynlibrary.org/podcast, as well as a link to the book match list, historic photos of Barren Island, and our Civil Rights in Brooklyn oral history collection.
So in the new year, we're putting together an episode about falling in love with the library. So we want to hear from you. Send us an email and tell us about a time that you fell in love at the library. Our email is podcasts@bklynlibrary.org.
Borrowed is produced and written by Virginia Marshall with help from Fritzi Bodenheimer, Meryl Friedman, Jennifer Prophet, and Robin Lester Kenton. Our music composer is Billy Libby.
Borrowed will be back in 2 weeks. Until then, reduce, reuse, recycle.